Hello, I'm Paola, and welcome to A Contemplative Revolution, a podcast by the WCCM, about what it means to live a contemplative, spiritual, and Christian life while still playing an active role in our modern world. Join us for conversations with fellow contemplatives in action from around the globe. In this episode, we'll hear from Sarah Batchelor, a theologian, retreat leader, and a priest in the Anglican Orders. Sarah was also a keynote speaker at the John Main Seminary in Montreal and Vancouver. This is part of a series of six talks called A Living Hope, The Shape of Christian Virtue, on what virtue means in spirit and in practice in a time like ours. We hope you enjoy this talk.
So, welcome to everyone joining us from different parts of the world for the fifth in Sarah's series of talks. And welcome, Sarah. Thank you again for leading us into this very important and stimulating inquiry. And today you're, I think, going to be speaking about Christian virtue in the life of the world and reflecting upon how it can be, how we can remain virtuous while being engaged with public life and political life. So thank you. We are all ears.
Thank you, Father Lawrence, and thank you, everybody. Welcome back again, and to this fifth talk. Slight marathon this series, but it's good to be with you, and good to be able to unpack things in a kind of extended way. So as Lawrence said, the title of tonight's talk is Christian Virtue and the Life of the World. And as you know, we've been thinking about the shape and significance of Christian conceptions of virtue in the context of the world's current crisis. We're wondering how our prayer, discipleship, and action may contribute to the work of justice and compassion, and the emergence of the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. In the last couple of weeks, I've been suggesting that from a Christian perspective, virtues are the dispositions that grow in human beings as we are open to the Spirit of God, and as we practice disciplines for deepening our receptivity and response. As these virtues or ways of being are strengthened, our lives make visible the nature of God, whose Spirit is infusing ours. We become capable of participating more faithfully in divine action. And the pattern is that of Christ, whose humanity both reveals God and enacts God's reconciling love for the world. And last week, I said that a striking feature of the moral exhortations in the New Testament is the extent to which they are focused on the enabling of a distinctive human community, one that itself reflects and participates in the divine action. One not determined by pre-existing social limits, one that is committed to fullness of life for all. And last week I quoted Rowan Williams saying that the relations of Christians to each other is one of building up. We are engaged in Christ in constructing each other's humanity, bringing one another into the inheritance of power and liberty, whose form is defined by Jesus. When these relations in a Christian community are healthy, such a community judges many other forms of human sociality. Not in the sense so much of condemning them, but by revealing their limits and their cost. For example, it shows up the destructive dynamics of communities based on rivalry or competition for honour. or the cost of communities generated by the systemic exclusion of people who are deemed not fully to belong, or the cost of those communities seeking to secure their own good at the expense of the vulnerable. We're so used to the idea of universal community that we forget how novel was the Christian proclamation of such unconditional belonging and value. It helps to hear afresh the New Testament's rejoicing in the sociality created by Christ's welcome and call. In the words of the text we've been working with, 1 Peter, writing to his Gentile readers, "Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy." Well, many commentators have pointed out that in a different way, our current health and economic crisis is also unveiling the limits and costs of aspects of contemporary sociality. Our crisis is apocalyptic in the sense that it reveals or uncovers what many have not been able or willing to see. An interview with the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor by Vladimir Volrab on our own WCCM's Contemplative Path website articulates this well. Taylor says, "The crisis shows how badly we have let certain of our public institutions run down and decay. This includes health services and those related to the care of the elderly. It is scandalous," Taylor notes, "that in Western societies which have been getting richer, as measured by GDP over the last decade, these services have been squeezed by austerity and other cost-cutting measures." And he goes on, "Part of the reason is that we have been seeing our economies as mainly aimed at producing more and more consumer goods for individuals. This is what we have really considered growth, and this growth has been our prime good. The public sectors have been squeezed because expenditure on these didn't contribute to growth. That is, producing and selling more and more individual goods. This," he says, "has been at the root of our ecological crisis, and now we see that this has hampered our response to the pandemic." Well, if we understand the crisis as in this sense apocalyptic or revelatory, we can also see how certain ways of talking about it function to distract us from what is being unveiled. Take the imagery of the virus as an invisible enemy or an invisible mugger, to use Boris Johnson's phrase. These characterizations of the pandemic as an alien force or intruder on which we can wage war and which we can all unite in defeating, distract us from awareness that in fact wars of other kinds have been long underway by means of our economic and political arrangements. War against the life of our planet, war against the most vulnerable members of our societies, war played out on the bodies and lands of Syrians, Yemenis, and indigenous peoples the world over. And what many people, by no means only Christians, are saying is that we do not wish to defeat the virus or to win the war against the pandemic, only to return to a way of life which necessitates the continuous destruction of ecosystems and communities. A way of life which treats countless human and non-human lives as so much collateral damage. There is widespread awareness that the radical shock of these events opens the possibility of resetting the world's political, economic, and ecological course at a deep level. We seek true shalom, the peace of God. And so the question I'd like to open up in today's talk is the question of how persons and communities formed in the virtues we've been exploring, how we participate in this work of peacemaking and reconciliation. How do we live in the tragic gap between the way things are and the way we know they could be? How are followers of Jesus called to relate to and participate in the public and political life of the world? Well, this issue goes back to the New Testament itself. Jesus famously replied to a question concerning the legitimacy of paying taxes to Rome by recommending rendering what was due to Caesar, and to God, what was due to God. With this reply, he subverted the trap set for him at the time. But his response doesn't necessarily help us discern what is properly Caesar's in any given situation and what is properly God's. And in any case, if we take this saying programmatically, it risks leaving us living dividedly, as if there's part of our lives comprised of the duties and obligations of citizens and another part which is our religious observance. By the second generation of Christian believers, as we've seen in the text of 1 Peter, there's a consciousness of Christian communities being necessarily distinct from, even at odds with, their surrounding context. Readers are addressed as aliens and exiles, urged to stand fast in the face of the world's hostility and even times of persecution. Yet at the same time, there's also in this text what is for us an uncomfortably accommodationist dimension to its admonitions. Recipients are told to conduct yourself honorably among the Gentiles, where this turns out to involve accepting the authority of what look like morally suspect institutions in the name of good order and a public reputation. Well, theologically speaking, it seems that the tension between distinction from and cooperation with the world is intrinsic to the Christian vocation. On the one hand, as I've been saying, our discipleship and form of life is significantly counter to much of natural human sociality. There is in Christian communities to be freedom from manipulation and domination, a practice of radical love for the other, the relinquishing of compulsions to jostle for status, honour, meaning. And in our question time last week, awareness of the difference between this ethic of mutual humility and regard, by comparison with the honour-shame ethic of the ancient and much of the modern world, prompted the question whether authentic Christian life and witness requires some kind of separation from the life of the world along monastic or sectarian lines. On the other hand, the Gospels proclaim that God so loved the world. Jesus insists he does not come to create a community of the pure or of the elect, but to heal the whole of life and transform the life of the whole. As Williams notes, those who belong to Christ, those drawn into Christian community, are not new creations in the sense of having all their former relationships and affiliations cancelled. If we are considering how Christians are to relate to the life of the world, the question thus becomes how these former or these existing patterns of belonging can collaborate with the patterns of the new community, if at all. How the goals and priorities of these existing patterns are to be brought together with the constructive work of the kingdom or the body of Christ. When Jesus speaks to his disciples about who they are to be in the world, the metaphors he chooses are of salt, leaven, light. These are elements that connect to and enable their context, flavoring, enlivening, enlightening. So what does it look like to be a Christian citizen, civil servant, banker, academic, social or healthcare worker, politician, shop assistant, farmer, miner, truck driver, school teacher? How does the commitment to be informed by the virtues of faith, hope, and love, by generosity, humility, and justice, play out in the messy and what can feel like compromising contexts of institutional or commercial life in fragile democracies and consumerist economies? What is the relationship between public and private virtue? And how do I discern the difference between patiently forging a counter story in the midst of the world's violence, as James Allison puts it, and simply colluding in the perpetuation of unjust structures? Well, there are no general answers to these questions. Sometimes it can help to focus the issue by means of an obvious case. There are forms of human belonging which, when affirmed and endorsed as they are manifestly at odds with the kingdom, says Williams. Which means that the Christian is bound to say that anyone so involved needs to find a way of distancing themselves. The example he gives is that of Dietrich Bonhoeffer and his relationship to the Third Reich. Although there's a sense in which someone in Bonhoeffer's situation remains a citizen of his nation, things may get to the point where their most important Christian service to that nation may be resistance, active or passive, a calling of their community to account in the name of a wider human fellowship. Williams notes that this example is almost a cliche, but it highlights the fact that any racial group or language group or sovereign state whose policy or program it is to pursue its interest at the direct cost of others has no claim on the Christian's loyalty in itself. Well, that sounds right. But no state, institution, or economic system is perfect. Where a human collective is systematically murderous or genocidal, that's one kind of example. But what if we belong, as I do, to a nation that is in certain respects admirable, committed in broad terms to the rule of law and the well-being of at least a majority of its citizens, and yet in other respects is systematically oppressive, abusive, and irresponsible? The Australian government cruelly and indefinitely detains asylum seekers arriving by boat. and economically punishes even those who are grudgingly accepted as refugees, in contravention of international law and as a matter of deliberate policy. It fails to act in accord with key environmental protections and emissions reduction commitments. Both instances of pursuing perceived national or at least ideological interest at the direct cost of others. I have friends who work or have worked in the bureaucracies whose task it is to enact these policies. And all of us benefit from other aspects of the government's activities. How do we live in the midst of this? What is the Christian response? And what does it look like from a Christian perspective to encourage or enable systemic transformation, whether in a nation, an economic system, ecclesial structure, university, business, or local organisation? I've spent a lot of time over the years at protests and rallies. But at times, I've also felt the futility and even the potential counterproductivity of such forms of engagement. What is the relationship between dissent and distancing and other forms of closer, potentially more compromising engagement? As he wrestled with the question of how to respond faithfully to the nuclear threat of the early 1960s, Thomas Merton noted the poet Czesław Miłosz's concern about the danger of facile sloganeering on peace as on other subjects, and about the risks of making polarization worse. At the same time, Merton was convinced that to say nothing or to resile from public action altogether is no solution. You cannot turn away from action, but not all action is wise or creative. What might right action be for a contemplative? As I said, there are no final answers here. But let me sketch what I believe are necessary touchstones for a Christian response, a conceptual and spiritual framework that helps orient us to the key issues. The first touchstone concerns the need to distinguish between faithfulness and innocence. I've cited in other contexts words of theologian Andrew Shanks, which for me really helped to focus this issue. In a book intriguingly entitled Against Innocence, Shanks has pointed out that when it comes to doing the right thing, two motives are in most of us deeply intertwined. There is the genuine desire to do justice, and there is the desire to be justified, to be assured of our innocence. This second desire, he says, gets in the way of the first. It makes our ethical responses self-referencing, self-conscious. It distracts us and, as he says, turns us away from the authentic desire to be just. Instead of being genuinely other-directed, our concern is subtly but unmistakably self-centered. An example of what this might look like in the political realm, drawn again from the Australian context, is the decision of the Greens Party in 2009 not to back the then Labor government's introduction of a carbon pollution reduction scheme on the grounds that it didn't go far enough. Critics charge that in preferring the good, sorry, preferring the perfect to the good, an opportunity was lost that could have changed the trajectory of the climate debate in Australia. This claim is disputed by the Greens, that is, the fact that it would have changed the trajectory. This claim is disputed by the Greens, and it's not my purpose here to come to a judgment about this matter. My point is, however, that whether or not the charge is justified in this particular case, what such an example illustrates is the difficulty of discerning when something diverts from godly action to such an extent that it must be refused, and when the refusal itself reflects a kind of bad faith. In other words, when is a refusal to compromise a sign of true integrity? And when is it more about the desire to maintain one's own innocence or righteousness at the expense of others? And you can see how this kind of dilemma is intrinsic to much of our political, institutional, and organizational life, where the need to negotiate with competing conceptions of the good or to compromise for the sake of small gains confronts us daily. I've been suggesting that holiness of life, Christian virtue, is about making visible the nature of God and participating in the divine action to give and restore life. But in a world where circumstances oblige us to choose between more and less damaging, and therefore in respect of God, more and less opaque options, this means there is an inescapably tragic dimension to our action in the world. That's Rowan Williams again. It's important to say that this recognition is not an escape clause. Philosopher Raymond Gaita has criticized some who speak of the need to occasionally dirty one's hands, or who characterize the tragic burden of leadership in ways that romanticize or justify evil acts. Our implication in systemic injustice and the painful necessity of compromise and being compromised are to be lived not with complacency or a thrill, but in grief and penitence. And I'll come back to this. Yet this is what makes it necessary to distinguish between faithfulness and innocence. And perhaps there are times when it's only as I give up implicit preoccupation with my own innocence that space is created faithfully to participate with others, to discern the particulars of a situation and discover my responsibility in relation to it. And this brings us to a second and related touchstone, which is responsibility. For Bonhoeffer, it is the willingness to be responsible that is the cornerstone of Christian ethics. Responsible, as in responsive, to God and to the reality of the world. Responsible, as in answerable, personally accountable. I said in the first of these talks that for Bonhoeffer, we are not guaranteed of doing good by following a moral system, by conforming our behaviour to a predetermined set of principles, rules, values, or customs, even if they are Bible-based. This is because to give ourselves and our actions over to any such system is to outsource our responsibility, our answerability to the livingness of God's call and the livingness of the world. And one consequence of this call to responsibility is the built-in moral vulnerability of Christian life. Bonhoeffer writes, "Whereas all action based on ideology is already justified by its own principle, responsible action renounces any knowledge about its ultimate justification. Those who act on the basis of ideology consider themselves justified by their idea. Those who act responsibly place their action into the hands of God and live by God's grace and judgment. Responsible action, like faithful action, requires us to wake up to God and the situation we are in, to discern our call as best we can, and then to risk showing up in the world. But this suggests that responsible action is also concrete and limited. To quote Bonhoeffer again, action in accord with reality is limited by our creatureliness. We do not create the conditions for our action, but find ourselves already placed within them. In our action, we are bound by certain limitations from both the past and the future that cannot be leapt over. Our responsibility is not infinite, but limited. Nevertheless, within these limits, it includes the whole of reality." These last two sentences might seem contradictory, but I think he wants to say, on the one hand, that we cannot artificially narrow the scope of our moral concern so that we need only be responsible, for example, for our intentions and not the outcome of our actions, or responsible only for our immediate circle and not the neighbour who is far distant from us. Thus, our Christian responsibility includes, as he says, the whole of reality, the whole sphere of our action. At the same time, however, our responsibility is not infinite because we ourselves are limited.
Hi everyone, you're listening to A Contemplative Revolution, a podcast by the WCCM, about what it means to live a contemplative spiritual and Christian life while still playing an active role in our modern world. Just a quick reminder, if you like this show, be sure to subscribe, and if you want to learn more about the important work of the WCCM, you can find us online at wccm.org. And now, back to our show.
We are born into conditions we did not create and that we cannot change simply by fiat. The question thus pressed upon us concerns what is our actual concrete responsibility here and now. I can spend a lot of energy railing against injustice in general and how the system is failing the poor and the planet, and how someone should do something about it. I can be righteously indignant or helplessly overwhelmed, and usually both. But this general moral concern can serve to distract me from truly giving myself to the particular responsibilities that are mine. It can distract me from humbly participating in the larger reconciling work of God, which may include at times suffering a sense of the insufficiency and inadequacy of my contribution. The touchstone of responsibility focuses on our concrete responsivity. Given who God is, given how we are actually situated in life, given our particular gifts and call in particular circumstances, what is ours to do? What can you be and what will you be responsible for? A third and final touchstone that helps orient us to the question of public or political engagement is what I'm going to call the significance of holy imagination and creativity. There is much talk at the moment of reactivating the economy with a capital E. And we're familiar with such turns of phrase as the economy requires or the economy can't sustain some social good or another. Of course, there is such a thing as more or less prudent economic management of a household, an institution, a nation. And this management is connected to vital human goods, such as employment, the availability of housing and healthcare. But to reify the economy as if it had a life apart from ours, as if it could make its own demands and require us to sacrifice to it our children along with the natural world, is to make of it an idol. As Charles Taylor said, to set up some measure which everything else then gets subsumed to fulfill. Discipleship of Christ involves learning to recognize idolatry, the worship of penultimate reality when we see it. It involves keeping alive within us the imagination and perspective of the kingdom. So part of a Christian contribution to public and political life is the capacity to narrate things differently, to tell a different story about how the world is, as do artists, writers, poets, and visionaries from many traditions. This is the prophetic imagination, of which biblical scholar Walter Brueggemann writes, "Impossibly daring visions of the possible are the prerequisite to move beyond the truth so long held that it kills." Impossibly daring visions of the possible are the prerequisite to move beyond the so-called truth so long held that it kills. And this holy creativity may show up in other ways too. Such things as the creation of spaces and capacity for authentic rather than polarizing dialogue. The hosting of days of rest and renewal, where people might reconnect with a different sense of human need and rhythm. Creating a visible witness to fellowship across difference, whether socioeconomic, religious, or ethnic. I don't have time to flesh these suggestions out, but I'm wanting to gesture at least to the kind of public engagement and life in the public sphere that is not immediately focused on critique or reform, so much as on embodying and forming people for participation in the kingdom of God, beginning to live the new creation now. So to conclude, in this talk, I've hoped to say something about how people formed in the virtues we've been exploring are called to relate in the political arena and the life of the world. I've said that we are participants in divine action, seeking to be in and for the world in the way that God is in and for the world, looking to strengthen the wholeness in people and enable their growth and liberty and fuller life, looking to rejoice in and nourish the beauty of creation, and to enable true communion and peace among peoples. And we're called to participate in this divine action, starting from where we are, starting from our situation in families, communities, institutions, social systems, and cultures that may be more or less reflective of the being and action of God. So, what does it look like to be a Christian citizen, bureaucrat, leader, worker? Sometimes it will look like joining gratefully and cooperatively with what an organization or community is about. Sometimes it will look like constructive, critical dialogue. And sometimes like dissent, protest, refusal to go along. The range of our responses will depend not only on the character of the worldly entities with which we have to do, but also on how we discern our particular responsibility and call, and on how we are located with respect to power and agency. Earlier, I said there can be a tragic dimension to our action as we choose between more and less damaging options, and that this must be lived in penitence and grief. This may mean honestly acknowledging our powerlessness in a given situation. It may mean making difficult compromises or continuing faithful even while unsuccessful. For example, telling the truth in a meeting or a ministerial briefing, even if it won't make a difference to the outcome. Virtue in the public sphere might require not making it easy for a system to justify its actions to itself, or to forget the cost of a particular decision. Yet neither must being an irritant become a habit of self-righteousness. It is a spirit of generosity, humility, and openness to reconciliation that characterizes the work of God. I know this may seem frustratingly abstract and indefinite. Do I go to the damn rally or not? But in a way, that's the point. We are to be faithful rather than preoccupied with our innocence, which means being responsive to call and concretely responsible for what is ours to do, as we keep alive for ourselves and others the perspective of the peaceable kingdom. There is no program for realizing the dream of God on earth. Just the faith that all of life belongs ultimately to God, and the hope that if we give ourselves wholeheartedly in truth and in prayer and the risk of common life, we will be given grace to play our part. The end.
The end. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you. Very illuminating and challenging. So we invite people to send in their questions now. Let me just kick it off with one question. You quote Bonhoeffer and see him as a model or an example of Christian prophetic action, responsible taking a stand and so on, and suffering for it. And he did that out of a very specific, as an ordained Lutheran pastor, explicit, and a theologian explicitly, standing on his Christian faith. But someone like Simone Weil might almost be more of a model for many people today, because although she was Christian and had a profound conversion and experience of Christ, she always refused to institutionalize it, to be in the church. Mm. And many people today might feel in that position. You know, they have a more or less orthodox attitude towards Christ, but calling themselves Christian or being affiliated to the church could be a personal problem to them. So what difference does it make, do you think, if you have people working on the same cause for justice, and some of them specifically identifying their motivation as Christian and others absolutely not? Does that make a difference, or is it just a personal subjective thing, do you think?
Well, I think in many respects it doesn't make a difference, and I guess that, you know, part of what I just saying at the end, you know, sometimes, you know, I guess I've been unpacking specifically the shape of Christian virtue, but that doesn't mean either that you always have to kind of badge yourself or label yourself, and also it doesn't mean, and I've tried to be careful to say this, that it's not only Christians who care about these things in this kind of a way, and where there's the possibility of collaboration or cooperation or shared work in justice and compassion, then that's, you know, that's the kingdom, I think. So I guess, you know, there may come points where that work is sourced in a person makes a difference. In certain circumstances, it might make a difference to whether you feel able to keep going under certain circumstances, or whether you would, you know, compromise in this way or that way in certain circumstances. So it could make a difference, but I don't think it's not a matter of the kind of self-conscious badging of it. It's more the discerning of action in accord with what I've been, I guess, unpacking as something of our understanding of the nature of God, the humility of God, the reconciling love of God. That would be the kind of the core of it, and how people self-identified isn't the major issue.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Just very appreciative comments coming in. Thank you for this wonderful series, truly hopeful and inspiring. And Leslie asks, I think everybody listening, of all the avenues and rivers developing from these weeks, is there one area in particular that stands out for you? So asking us to reflect on that. There's a question from Maximo, you picking up on your quotation of
Jesus.
Many of us are working to support our families, but our jobs, corporate jobs, for example, are not contributing directly to the common good. Things like social justice and environment protection. Can you reflect on how to balance these two aspects, our work, our office work, and the change we want to see in society?
Yeah, it's a great question, Maximo. And I guess in a way, this was part of what I was trying to, you know, begin to engage this exactly this question, which I know, you know, is a very, you know, many people's, perhaps even most people's experience. You know, I guess what I've tried to say is that it is a matter of a few factors. One is to do with the corporate job and what it's actually doing. You know, there's a scale of jobs that are some which seem quite destructive and kind of undermining of others. Other jobs which are just kind of jobs which don't feel particularly destructive, but also don't feel, as you say, that they're contributing directly. And I guess part of it is this whole question, Bonhoeffer's question really, of given your situation in life, given how you find yourself placed and the responsibilities that you have to family and other commitments, but also given your, you know, responsibility as responsive to the call of God on your life, what are you called to? How do you participate? Are there ways to participate externally to your job, to some of the other things that you want to see brought about, or so on? There's no kind of, I'm really sorry, but there's no answer. I don't think there's not kind of a formula. It is about this kind of discernment, this honesty, this realism, and this is where I think that Bonhoeffer's idea, our responsibility isn't infinite. It is limited. It's limited by what we can do, given who we are, our situation. But that doesn't let us off the hook and think, oh, well, look, I'm just a small, you know, person in the scheme of things, and I'll leave that to other people. So it is a complex balance, I think, and it's a complex one in our society and historical moment, I think.
Thank you. I think the other question from someone, anonymous attendee, is maybe similar to that, but maybe is asking again for something specific suggestion. How can you be creative about challenging governments that say that they are working for the poor, but in fact are much more concerned about their own politics and do not embody this principle and create division in society? How can we challenge hypocritical governments?
Yeah. I think this is where, and I like the word, the question about the creative. I mean, obviously protest is one form of seeking to challenge government that are being hypocritical or not saying not doing what they say they want to do. But there are, for example, I know of a project that's underway here in Australia, which is looking to create conversations across Australia, particularly drawing in women in the first instance. So on the question of climate change, the Women's Climate Congress, and the idea is that a bit like there was a Women's Congress before the First World War, where women from all different kind of socioeconomic backgrounds and nationalities got together to seek to find a way to broker peace in the face of this kind of warmongering. Seeking to engage the politics of climate in Australia, which have become so polarised, by way of lots and lots of local conversations and authentic dialogue and conversation rather than just protest. So that's a creative way of trying to respond to an impasse. And, you know, I don't know the particular context here, but I think this search for what, if we're seeking to be responsive out of this dynamic of a commitment to hospitality, a commitment to the possibility of authentic reconciliation, even when it feels like we're poles apart from people, what might be a means that's congruent with the ends that we'd like to achieve? And I think there is some creative work that can be done in thinking that through.
Thank you. Maybe another take on that is illustration of what you just said comes from Terry Doyle's question or comment, where he refers to the two doves on the chalice, the WCCM symbol, representing action and contemplation. And he's suggesting that meditatio, which is the outreach of our community, is bearing strategic responsibility of prophetically and courageously engaging with the different spheres of public life, finance, education, social justice, environment, etc. We're in France here, where French community is initiating a meditatio seminar over a period of weeks, actually, online, on the environment. It begins on Thursday, actually. So he says, surely we all have a personal sphere of influence wherein we can make a positive difference and collectively then become a real force for good when we join in together in silent prayer, so as to then act out the fruits of this practice in contemplative outreach in our own communities. Mm. So this dynamic, really, of action and contemplation, do you see that at the heart of it?
Yeah, I do. And I think it's that contemplative prayer that keeps us, you know, grounded and sourced in this, you know, that's kind of what I keep calling the divine life, the divine action. And it's from that place that we're seeking to act. So, and I think it's acting from there that also helps our action not just to become shrill or self-righteous, but to kind of have this dimension of generosity but also of real courage and real prophetic authority.
Thank you. I think we've got a couple of minutes more if you've got the time. Brian makes this comment, which is a question for you. My associates and most members of my family do not have a faith, but they are very moral and conscientious. We do not disagree on the big issues that you have raised, but God is not necessary in our conversation. God would be a distraction.
Hmm. Well, I guess I'd sort of refer back to the answer about Bonhoeffer and Vey. Again, I part of what I've been seeking to do is to unpack what is the Christian conception of virtue or goodness. Christianity is a particular tradition. It has a particular, you know, historical practice of prayer and service and action. And we can use words like generosity or hospitality or whatever, but not really get in touch with the, you know, the depth dimension or their sourcing in this particular tradition. So what I've been seeking to do is to unpack that depth dimension and then to begin to explore how that plays out in our life in the world. And that can be helpful for people who are part of this tradition who want to make those connections. If it's not helpful, don't worry about it.
I think it relates to a question you raised during the John Main seminar, when you gave it on contemplative Christianity. I know you're working hard on editing your talks for that to be published. But you asked the question, why bring God into meditation? So many people today believe in meditation and want to meditate and take it seriously, but they would say, I don't need God in this? Mm. And you had a very interesting answer to that, I think, a very relevant answer to that, which I'm sure you remember. I think, well, it was about this transcendental depth dimension, that it makes a difference at the same time.
Yes, and I guess, again, I think part of the difficulty with speaking about things like Christian virtue is because Christianity has, you know, a lot of historical baggage for having been oppressive or colonizing or dismissive of other traditions, there can be then a sense of allergy to Christianity as if it's always colonizing. And I totally get that dimension, and that critique is often well deserved. And I guess my sense is there is something, there is a resource that this tradition and contemplating in this tradition offers, which is worth paying attention to, at least worth seeking to understand what that is, how we think of that, and then. Some of us discover that it does make a difference to the kind of the quality of our lives.
You've been listening to A Contemplative Revolution, a podcast by the WCCM. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. To learn more about our guest or anything else mentioned in the episode, please check out the links in the show notes or visit us online at wccm.org.